What does it mean to be a Western yogi? How can someone who was born and raised in the West, who comes from a Judeo-Christian background, practice yoga and meditation in an authentic and genuine way? My name is Christopher Sartain, and this is the Western Yoga Podcast. Greetings, fellow seekers. Welcome to another episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. It's a beautiful sunny winter day here in southern Chile at our small ashram. We woke up to about 3 centimeters of snow this morning, and so I'm enjoying the views of the winter wonderland here in the southern Andes. We'll continue our exploration of the Gospel of Thomas today in this episode. And in particular, I'd like to read some passages out of Ancient Christian Gospels by Helmut Kester, a wonderful book that I highly recommend you read if you can get through it. It's a scholarly, academic work, and if you do not have a background in biblical studies and early Christian history and all of that, it can be quite difficult to get through, but I do highly recommend reading it because I base a lot of my research on the Gospel of Thomas on Helmut Kester's work in this book, Ancient Christian Gospels. So I'd like to read some passages out of this book regarding the Gospel of Thomas, and then we can talk about some of the ideas that he presents. And then I'll close by reading a couple of verses out of the Gospel of Thomas along with my commentary. So let's start on page 75 of Ancient Christian Gospels, where the author introduces the Gospel of Thomas. A Coptic translation of the Gospel of Thomas was identified in Cairo in the year 1948 in one of the codices of the Nag Hammadi Library, which had been found in Upper Egypt in the fall of 1945. In the spring of 1948, when 11 of the original 13 codices of the Nag Hammadi Library were still in the hands of the Cairo antiquities dealer, Fokion Tano, Jean Dores was retained to photograph some of the manuscripts and to prepare an inventory of the tractates. At the end of the second tractate of Codex II, Dores read the words inscribed in titular fashion in the middle of the page, "The Gospel According to Thomas." In 1957, Pahor Labib, the director of the Coptic Museum in Cairo, published a series of photographs of leaves from the new codices, among them the pages from Codex II containing the Gospel of Thomas. Within a year, Jean Dores published a French translation, and the East German scholar Johannes Liepold published a German translation of the Gospel of Thomas. The Coptic text was published a year later with French, German, and English translations. It soon became apparent that some parts of the Gospel of Thomas had indeed been known for many decades. 3 Greek papyri with sayings of Jesus, all written around 200 CE, had been found in Oxyrhynchus in Egypt in the years 1897, 1903, and 1904, respectively. These papyri are actually portions of the Greek original of the Coptic Gospel of Thomas. The discovery of the full Coptic text made it possible to reconstruct the entire Greek text of these fragmentary papyri. The definitive publication of the Coptic text and the reconstructed Greek fragments, together with translations and introductions, are now available in a volume of Nag Hammadi Studies edited by Bentley Layton. The three Oxyrhynchus papyri had been widely discussed in the first decades of this century and valued highly by some scholars as possibly original sayings of Jesus, but it was not clear whether these three papyri belonged to any particular gospel. No doubt all three Oxyrhynchus fragments are part of the Greek text of the Gospel of Thomas, yet they are not portions of one single manuscript, and they do not necessarily represent the Greek text from which the Coptic translation was made, yet they do not derive from the Coptic text, but are independent developments of the Greek original underlying the Coptic translation. Thus, the Gospel of Thomas is well attested as a Greek gospel writing that circulated widely during the 2nd century. The attestation is just as strong as that for the canonical gospels. Now from page 80. The designation Gospel of Thomas was added later at the end of the document by the scribe who copied it. The incipit designates the writings as a Book of Secret Sayings. Normally, each saying is introduced by Jesus said. The sayings are not embedded into a narrative framework, although occasionally the disciples are introduced as asking questions. There are no references to the story of Jesus, no mention of his birth, life, death, and resurrection. Rather, Jesus is simply designated as, quote-unquote, the living one. The author was certainly not trying to compose a gospel of the type that is known from the Gospels of the New Testament. Just stringing sayings together into a written document is a mode of composition that was well known from wisdom books, like the Book of Proverbs from the Hebrew Bible, or the Wisdom of Ben Sira and the Wisdom of Solomon, which are preserved among the so-called Old Testament Apocrypha. There are also early Christian examples for this type of literature. Most scholars believe that both Matthew and Luke used, as a common source, a collection of Jesus' sayings known as the Synoptic Sayings Source, or Q. The Epistle of James in the New Testament is such a wisdom book. The sayings of the Gospel of Thomas consist for the most part of proverbs, wisdom sayings, parables, prophetic sayings about the kingdom of the Father, and community rules. Wisdom is the theme of this writing. As in the Wisdom of Solomon, wisdom sayings express the truth about God and about the essence of the human self. They speak about human nature and destiny, and by extension, about the nature of the world and the proper relationship to the world in which people dwell. The wisdom sayings of the Gospel of Thomas, like other Jewish and Christian sayings collections of this type, contain sayings that reveal what is fundamental about people and their behavior. Still other sayings point to the tenuous nature of a human being's sojourn in the world. Such wisdom sayings, as well as many others, have parallels in the canonical Gospels. Thus, such sayings and the orientation they reveal are by no means unique to Thomas. They are typical of the early Christian sayings tradition to which Thomas, together with Matthew, Mark, and Luke, was heir. Now page 86, talking about Thomas and the Synoptic Sayings Source, or Q, now, the relationship there. One of the most striking features of the Gospel of Thomas is its silence on the matter of Jesus' death and resurrection, the keystone of Paul's missionary proclamation. But Thomas is not alone in this silence. The Synoptic Sayings Source, Q, used by Matthew and Luke, also does not consider Jesus' death a part of the Christian message. And it likewise is not interested in stories and reports about the resurrection and subsequent appearances of the risen Lord. The Gospel of Thomas and Q challenge the assumption that the early church was unanimous in making Jesus' death and resurrection the fulcrum of Christian faith. Both documents presuppose that Jesus' significance lay in his words and in his words alone. Another striking feature of the Gospel of Thomas is an almost total absence of Christological titles such as Christ, Messiah, Lord, and Son of Man. With respect to the latter title, the Gospel of Thomas and Q part company. In Q, the title Son of Man plays a significant role as a designation of Jesus as the one who will appear from heaven at the end of the time. As the lightning flashes and lights up the sky, so will the Son of Man be in his day, Luke chapter 17, verse 24. Similar statements about the Son of Man also appear in the so-called Synoptic Apocalypse, Mark 13, and Matthew 24 and 25. But in recent studies, Dieter Lohrmann and following him, John S. Kloppenborg, have demonstrated that Q was composed in two successive stages, and that the understanding of Jesus as the future Son of Man was not yet present in the earlier stage of its composition. The sayings, which speak about the coming of the Son of Man for the final judgment and the addition of the title of Son of Man to older sayings, belong to the second stage of this document, which originally presented Jesus as a teacher of wisdom and as a prophet who announced in his words the presence of the kingdom. It is exactly with respect to the material that belongs to the earlier stage of Q, written probably within 10 or 20 years of Jesus' death, that we find parallels in the Gospel of Thomas. Of the 79 sayings of Thomas with synoptic gospel parallels, 46 have parallels in Q. But the typical apocalyptic perspective of the later redaction of Q does not appear in any of these sayings. Rather, they are non-apocalyptic wisdom sayings, proverbs, prophetic sayings, parables, and community rules. Yeah. And then he gives a list of all of those in the next couple of pages. But I won't go through all of that. So a lot of really deep, profound wisdom that requires a lot of unpacking, because so much was just said there that would be considered completely revolutionary for any Orthodox Christian, Catholic, Protestant, for, let's say, 90-something percent of Christians would find what I just read completely and utterly revolutionary and transformative, because it eradicates, really, the modern Christian religion, or what came to be the modern Christian faith as it is practiced today, which is based in large part upon Paul and Paul's interpretation of Jesus and Jesus's life and teachings and all of that, and has very little to do with Jesus' actual teachings and Jesus' actual life, and completely the Orthodox view of Christianity completely leaves out also a lot of the really important historical context surrounding Jesus at that time, and the fact that he and John the Baptist and other people within Jesus' family and some of his disciples and whatnot were many of them probably associated with the Essene sect of Judaism. And I encourage you to go back and listen to all of the episodes in this series about the Gospel of Thomas and the Essenes, and I give a lot more history and context in those episodes. So I encourage you to go back and listen to those episodes. So I won't go into detail about the Essenes in this episode. But needless to say, Orthodox Christianity, or modern mainstream Christianity, leaves out so many important historical details about Jesus' life, about John the Baptist, about the Essenes, and of course, it excludes the Gospel of Thomas, because the so-called canonical Gospels were trying to paint a different picture of Jesus and his life, which I also explain in previous episodes. And so, what we have in the Gospel of Thomas is the idea that Jesus was essentially an awakened teacher that was teaching his disciples the way to awakening, the way to enlightenment. And this is what we find in the Gospel of Thomas, that his teachings were the priority. His teachings were what was most important for his disciples and for him and for himself, for Jesus himself. It says that the document presupposes that Jesus' significance lay in his words and in his words alone. In other words, for Jesus, that was what was important, what he was passing along to his disciples. That's what's important for any spiritual master, spiritual teacher, guru, is to pass on the teachings and to initiate disciples who will hopefully later have their own disciples, you see, and continue the lineage of enlightenment on planet Earth into future generations. That is the purpose or role of any spiritual teacher or any enlightened master who chooses to teach. And so Jesus was no different from any other awakened being, awakened teacher who has ever existed here on planet Earth. That was his mission, that was his role, that was his purpose, is to teach others how to wake up as he had, so that they could teach others how to wake up as they had, so on and so forth. That is the purpose of any spiritual lineage. Jesus was part of such a spiritual lineage. He was a student of John the Baptist, a disciple of John the Baptist. And then Jesus became a teacher in his own right. He surpassed even the level of John the Baptist's enlightenment, by far, in my opinion. And transcended, really, all of the Jewish teachings, any notion of religion, really. And so Jesus essentially transcended all religions, his teachings. All enlightenment teachings do so. All mystical teachings do so. So the mystical teachings of all religions transcend the religions themselves, which essentially means all mysticism is one, or is at least very, very similar. Because at the end, all mystical traditions prioritize experience over belief. If you read the Gospel of Thomas, a lot of the teachings have to do with experience of non-duality, of non-dual consciousness, of enlightened, awakened consciousness. And Jesus, in the Gospel of Thomas, doesn't focus on beliefs. And so the Gospel of Thomas is an enlightenment teaching. It's a mystical teaching, or a collection of mystical teachings. Okay? And so his words were what was most important. Not his death and resurrection and all of that. And by the way, I don't discount the validity of the reports of seeing Jesus after his death on the cross by some of his disciples. It's very possible. Many advanced yogis have the ability to go into a sort of state of stasis, where they're able to essentially stop breathing or almost stop breathing and get the heartbeat so slow that it almost appears as though one has died. And there are famous accounts of yogis burying themselves or going into caves alone and going into a state of stasis for a week or more and appearing as though they're dead for all intents and purposes. So it is quite possible that Jesus did die on the cross or went into a state of stasis in which he was able to awaken from that state when he was in the tomb. Okay? That's very possible. I don't discount that at all. Many advanced avatars have that capacity and ability. Some avatars even have, for example, in my tradition of Kriya Yoga, Mahavatar Babaji has the ability to manifest a form at will. In other words, he's sort of a causal being, or you have to understand the cosmology of yoga is that there are three planes of existence: a physical plane, an astral or energetic plane, and a causal or mental plane. Okay? And so it is possible that we can reincarnate into astral planes and then graduate to even higher causal planes as we ascend through the dimensions. Okay? And so it is thought that possibly Mahavatar Babaji is a causal being existing in a sort of mental plane, and that he has the ability to simply manifest a human body at will. And he does so from time to time in the Himalayas and works with very small groups of disciples secretly who do not disclose his location typically. And that's how he works. And he works from more subtle levels also, of course, constantly bringing an influence of light and compassion to the planet and its inhabitants and all life forms. At any rate, so I don't discount any of the stories regarding Jesus' resurrection after his death on the cross. It is quite possible that those stories are real and that he did actually do that, and that quite possibly perhaps he went on living on planet Earth after that for many more years. We don't know. I won't bore you with the details about the studies that essentially demonstrate or prove that Q was composed in two successive stages. So I'm not going to go into all of that, but there is a lot of evidence that that is the case, and that the sayings which speak about the coming of the Son of Man for the final judgment and the addition of the title Son of Man to older sayings belong to the second stage of this document, which originally presented Jesus as a teacher of wisdom. And furthermore, the original Q teachings are non-apocalyptic wisdom sayings, proverbs, prophetic sayings, parables, and community rules. Therefore, the original Q source, before it was redacted, before it was changed, probably by some of Paul's followers, okay, people from that sect, probably changed and altered a lot of the, redacted a lot of the original Q source material, and added their own later Q material, you see. But the original Q Q material, which we think comes from about 10 years after Jesus' death. The original first written Christian material was just a list of Jesus' sayings, wisdom sayings. And Jesus was presented as a teacher of wisdom. And the original written documents, the earliest written Christian material, the purest form of Christian written material. And the Q source presents Jesus as a wisdom teacher, in other words, an enlightened teacher, a spiritual master. And his teachings are essentially enlightenment teachings. Teachings about enlightenment that he's giving to his disciples, as all enlightened masters do. Jesus was no different. He probably had attained a much higher degree of enlightenment than many gurus and spiritual masters and all of that. But his teaching style wasn't all that different, really, when you think about it. And he worked with a small group of devoted disciples, as do most gurus or spiritual masters. But he also gave public sermons and public teachings for the masses as well, that were more easily understood and more practical. But he reserved the esoteric, mystical, enlightenment teachings for a select few, and those were his closest disciples. Thomas probably being the most advanced of all of them. I'd like to read a couple of verses now from the Gospel of Thomas, verse 24. Oh, by the way, I'm reading from the Thomas Lambden translation. There are several translations of the Gospel of Thomas, but this is one of the earliest, and for some reason I really resonate with it. Verse 24, his disciples said to him, "Show us the place where you are, since it is necessary for us to seek it." He said to them, "Whoever has ears, let him hear. There is light within a man of light, and he lights up the whole world. If he does not shine, he is darkness." In Christianity in general, in the Bible, as well as the Gospel of Thomas, there's an emphasis on this idea of light, spiritual light. In my own tradition of Kriya Yoga, there's also an emphasis on spiritual light, and even the developing, cultivating the ability to see the inner light, which is typically referred to as jyoti. And you can develop, I remember when I first began seeing this inner light, I was at a meditation retreat in the North Georgia Mountains at a retreat center there, not Center for Spiritual Awareness, another retreat center, doing a different form of meditation called Vedic Rounding with Graham Fowler, the director of Peachtree Yoga Center in Atlanta, who's also a very important teacher of mine. At any rate, I had a very profound sort of breakthrough experience, my first real powerful breakthrough meditation, where I experienced a state that lasted several hours and really had effects that lasted, well, up till this day, really, but some noticeable changes that occurred after that experience. And one of those changes was the ability to see this inner light, this brilliant, constant inner light in my third eye chakra, in the Ajna chakra, where the when you close the eyes and look up into the forehead, there's just always a light there, even to this day. But it started at that after that breakthrough meditation that I had at that retreat back in 2012. Yeah, I was 33 at the time, and I began to see this inner light, this jyoti that Paramahansa Yogananda talks about, and Swami Muktananda talks about in his books as well. Many yogis talk about it. The ancient texts talk about it, and it's an important part of Christianity as well, and Western mystical traditions, this notion of the spiritual light. And so Christ in this verse talks about light, and he says, well, first of all, he says, whoever has ears, let him hear. And we have to unpack that. He says sometimes, you know, having the eyes to see, the ears to hear, and all of that. What he's talking about there is developing our discernment and being able to really hear and really see. So when he's giving teachings to his disciples, he wants them to be alert. He wants them to be discerning. He wants them to be fully present and attentive so that they can receive what he's giving. And so he reminds them the importance of having the eyes to see, the ears to hear. And really what he's talking about there is cleaning the filters. Cleaning our mental filters so that when he's giving teachings or just by his mere presence, he's able to transmit something to them. When their filters are clean, they're able to truly receive it, truly hear it, truly see it. So that's what he's referring to there. He says, there is light within a man of light, and he lights up the whole world. So he's not necessarily referring to himself there. In a way he is, but in a way he's telling them that they too can be men of light and that they too can light up the whole world. Because he knows, you know, my guru, Roy Eugene Davis, used to say, when one person wakes up, the entire world becomes a little bit brighter. Meaning, when one person wakes up, all of humanity wakes up a little more. You know, we're all connected. There is no separation. We're all part of this collective consciousness. We're all part of this universal mind. We all share it. It's all non-local. And there is no separation. There is no distance. It's an illusion. And so he's encouraging them. In the Gospel of Thomas, and even we find in the New Testament, in the Bible as well, he says, you know, he encourages them to be like him. You know, and that they can be like him. And he's very encouraging. But he understood the connectivity in everything, the relatedness of everything, the interconnectivity of everything, and the collective consciousness that we all share. And he understood that when one person wakes up, it has this collective effect on all of humanity, especially when it's so bright, so brilliant, as Christ was, as a liberated avatar. And so someone like that, an individual like that, can have a profound effect on humanity. If he does not shine, he is darkness. So in other words, if you are not awake, if you're not enlightened, you're living in Maya. You're living in the illusion. You're living in darkness. You're going through the motions. You're on autopilot. You're sleepwalking through your life, unaware of your true nature as a spiritual being, as a cosmic traveler, incarnating for a short time on this planet, engaging in the drama of the planet for a time as a learning experience. If he does not shine, he is darkness. So in other words, if you're not awake, if you're not experiencing at least, a semi-enlightened stage of awakening, then you're participating in the darkness. You're mired in Maya. And you're not awake to what you actually are. And so we have this idea of light, enlightenment, spiritual light, spiritual enlightenment. It's in the word itself, enlightenment. And so this notion of light is a recurring theme in Christianity, in many religions. In all mystical traditions, everyone speaks of the mystical light. And it is possible to perceive this light in the higher chakras, in deep meditative states. Most Kriya yogis, who I know personally, after some time practicing the Kriya techniques, almost all report that they see this spiritual light as well. So this is an important part of most esoteric or mystical traditions, the idea of the spiritual light, the inner light, the jyoti. And we are light. We are that. We are pure beings of light, of spiritual light, pure rays of God's light. That is what you are. At your core, yeah, underneath all the fluctuating vibratory phenomenon, you are a pure ray of God's light. Sinless, stainless, without karma, liberated. That is your true nature. Verse 26, Jesus said, "You see the mote in your brother's eye, but you do not see the beam in your own eye. When you cast the beam out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to cast the mote from your brother's eye. Judge not, lest ye be judged." No? I love this verse. I find that so often on the spiritual path, we tend to criticize others who we see on the path who aren't maybe walking the path as we would walk it. And so we judge them and we criticize them, and they say, oh, well, they shouldn't be doing that thing or that little thing, or, oh, they ought to be doing it this way or teaching it that way or what have you. And the ego loves that. The ego loves to judge others. The ego does not like introspection. It prefers to look outward and to judge others, to inflate itself, you see. And it does not like introspection. It avoids introspection at all costs. It's constantly avoiding introspection. And this is a trick of Maya. This is a trick of the ego. So before you comment on how dirty, but before you comment on the disorder in someone else's closet, you should clean your own closet first. Worry about your own closet before you start commenting on the closets of others. You're not perfect. I'm not perfect. No one is perfect. So none of us should really be judgmental or critical of others until we are perfect. Mm-hmm. Until we are, I'm not sure perfection exists. That's for another podcast. But until we are somewhat Christ-like, or Buddha-like, or Yogananda-like, we really shouldn't be passing judgment on others, because we have our own stuff to work out, don't we? If we're all honest with ourselves. And so this was Jesus' teaching in this verse. Practice introspection, focus on yourself, focus on your own stuff. You know, the best thing you can do for others is wake up. So that the enlightenment path is not a selfish path. Meditation is not selfish. Yeah. Wanting to wake up is not selfish. In fact, it's the most selfless act you can do, really, is your spiritual practice and all of that. Because if you're purifying yourself, and you're constantly elevating your state of consciousness and your stage of awakening, this has a collective effect. And your energetic state, the corresponding energetic and physical state that accompanies the enlightenment process, is very beneficial for all those around you, and the plant life around you, the rocks around you, the crystals around you, the water around you. Everything around you begins to benefit from your awakening and your purification. We have to understand that there is a corresponding physical state, an energetic state, that accompanies the enlightenment condition, so to say. And so that people who become enlightened, their energy changes, and their body, their physical body changes. And Yogananda referred to this as the spiritualizing of the body, the spiritualizing of the cells, and all that. He knew. So the energetic body, or astral body, and the physical body of an enlightened being is different from a normal, ordinary person. And so this has an effect on the environment surrounding the person, and it has a subtle effect on the collective consciousness of the planet and other planets. The entire universe is affected. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share the podcast with your friends and like-minded folks. And we'll continue this series about the Gospel of Thomas in future episodes. Thank you so much for listening. Many blessings. Namaste.